I am haunted by a recurring nightmare. I am underwater, and I am trapped under the ice of a frozen lake, clawing desperately, but futilely, attempting to catch a breath of air somewhere in the frigid water, and my chest hurts, and my heart is pounding, and I can't find an opening. I'm desperate. I'm hopeless. Now, this recurring nightmare is not, as far as I know, caused by some profound childhood trauma or some deep Freudian horror that I can't access. It's caused by my allergies. When I'm horizontal and the heat is on in the house and my dust mite allergies kick in, my sinuses, when I'm horizontal and sleeping, close up tight, hermetically sealed. And if I'm dreaming, my subconscious will incorporate my inability to breathe, my inability to catch a breath, my inability to do much of anything. And my subconscious will put me into a situation where that's the case. So it'll put me under the ice, or buried in dirt, or stuck upside down in a chimney flue. That's my worst. Or some other place where I can't breathe or move, and I'm terrified, and I'm stuck, and then suddenly, I'm awake, and I'm alive. It's good. And the dog is gently snoring on the floor, and the one I love is sleeping soundly next to me, and there's no need to be afraid. There's no need to be afraid, but there may be a need for me to go into the bathroom and use my neti pot before I go to bed again. Boy, my chest hurts just reading that, or just telling that story. When I read this story from John 20, I find myself hyperventilating like I do when I awake from my recurring nightmare. The followers of Jesus are in a nightmare turned real. Their leader, their teacher, their friend has been arrested and killed by the Roman military government. And they are certain they are next. They have locked themselves in a room out of desperate fear, a cramped tomb of hopeless paralysis, the air poisoned by betrayal and death and entrapment. They're stuck under the cold spiritual death of their hopes and their dreams, dying just as their lovely and beloved rabbi did. They have nothing to look forward to but more fear and more death. Even the crazed story of some of the women that they've seen Jesus alive, that brings no comfort, for these followers have betrayed him and abandoned him and denied him in his hours of need. Quick translation aside, I am aggrieved by John's use of the word translated as Jews or Judeans here. It says, the doors of the house where the disciples had met were locked for fear of the Jews or the Judeans. John was writing about the disciples' fear of Herod's soldiers or the temple police or even the secular Roman military, but Christians for almost 2,000 years have used this translation and other seemingly anti-Jewish verses from John's gospel to create the recurring nightmare of anti-Semitism that has infected the church. It is important to remember that Jesus and all his followers were and always were Jewish. When he's saying fear of the Jews, he's not talking about the Jews, but about particular authorities who are out there to arrest them. I'm off that soapbox. Back to the sermon. The disciples are in this confined, entrapped, airless space. And it is into that place that the risen Jesus comes. Not with the expected words of judgment and anger, but with words of forgiveness and healing and promise. Shalom aleichem. Peace be with you. I suspect for them it was like waking from a nightmare where you couldn't breathe. The guilt of betrayal, of doubt, of fear, the self-loathing are all gone and forgotten and blown away by a divine breath, filling lungs and hearts and souls with new life, filling them with forgiveness and with hope and with faith. Breathe it all in, disciples. Receive the Holy Spirit, Jesus says. Receive my life-giving breath. Live, truly live by the Spirit. As Abba, the Father, has sent me, so I send you. In one breath of peace, each disciple's entrapment and fear and suffocation is transformed into a calling, into a dream of purpose and mission out in the world to love as Jesus loved, to forgive as Jesus forgave. Well, except for one guy. And that's our buddy Thomas, the twin. And man, we call him the doubter. That's so not fair. Because I wonder, why isn't he in the room? Everyone is scared of getting arrested and killed, and Thomas isn't there, which means he's outside somewhere in the danger zone. Which means he's not ruled by fear, the fear that paralyzed the others. Thomas was already out in the world, despite the risk of arrest, out in the world like Jesus was asking the disciples to do while Thomas was already out there. Now, I suspect Thomas is not out on a street corner preaching the gospel with a bullhorn. None of you should be. He's probably out getting groceries. They have a room full of bachelors. We need Doritos, dude. But the fact that he's not hiding behind locked doors, I think, might make him more faithful than the 10 others who are trapped beneath the ice of their fear. But because he's out there in the world, he misses something big. He misses this amazing event where Jesus comes among the disciples. He missed it, and he's hurt, and he feels left out. And Thomas, because of that, gets a whole lot of flack for not taking the experience of the other 10 disciples at face value. Now, given the track record of the 10 disciples who are left, would you trust anything they say? When they say, "We have seen the Lord," what he says next is really important. He doesn't say, "You guys are full of it. I'm out of here. You're stupid." No, he says, "Unless I see the mark of the nails in his hands and I put my finger in the mark of the nails and my hand in his side, I will not believe." He's not asking for proof. He's asking for an experience. He's not asking for an intellectual proof of what has happened. He wants to touch and experience Jesus. And what's crucially important is that's exactly where Jesus meets him in the next verse. When his friends told him, "We have seen the Lord," he refuses to believe. Just their story, and demanded to touch and probe Christ's wounded body, and he responds by coming again and inviting him to put your finger here and to see my hands and to put out your hand and place it in my side. This is a powerful invitation from Jesus, not to a creed or to a church or to a denomination or a theological position, but to come close and experience the presence of Jesus. He is saying, look closely, be at home with me. Don't be afraid to touch me. You will neither hurt nor offend me. The disciples, and especially Thomas, are urged to look at his wounds, to recognize him in his woundedness, to make sure that they are in the presence of Christ, the risen Christ, not some ghost, not some imposter, but their friend and teacher. I have a hard time thinking of how I would behave in that situation if Jesus showed up and said, stick your hand right in there, yeah. That's not how I was brought up. I was always taught as a child, it's not polite to stare, particularly at the hurts, at the wounds and the distortions that afflict other folk. My sophomore year as an undergraduate, I had a roommate who had lost his lower half of his leg to cancer. And he wore a prosthetic leg sometimes, but he hated it. And so usually he was in a chair. And he was on the wheelchair basketball team and was awesome. But the first week... The first week of school, I don't remember his exact words, but it was, we might as well get this over with, okay? And so he unwraps his leg from his prosthetic leg and says, this is what happened. This is what it looks like. Those are the scars. This is the thing. Touch it. I'm like, no, touch it. Okay, thanks. But it was great because we got it. I guess he'd had some experience the year before with a different roommate, and it was like, let's just get this over with, all right? Everything, bleh, done. And it was cool. I didn't have to stare at him anymore after that. Jesus urges them to probe his wounds. This is not a tentative little poke like I was invited to do, but the kind of rough exploratory touching that we experience from babies and small children. Who can't tell that eyeballs hurt or noses or ears hurt or stick their hand all the way into your mouth. He wanted the disciples to go beyond appearances and to know him and experience him. By his wounds, we are healed. Isaiah said that 500 years earlier. By his wounds, he is known. But the reality is that we are known by our wounds too. Even if we try to hide them. And I'm wondering if church shouldn't be the very place where we connect with each other, not by our strengths, but by our woundedness. I look around and I see folk who have disappeared from worship for weeks or months or years because you were wounded. Maybe wounded here. Maybe wounded by me. Or wounded outside but could not bear to show up here. Not looking like you have your stuff together. Because people would ask. Maybe people would point. People would wonder. People would pity. What would it take for us to be the first place we think to run to when we are wounded, rather than the last place we'd ever want to show up? In his 1948 novel, Ah, But Your Land Is Beautiful, a white anti-apartheid activist, Alan Paton, the author, tells the story of Robert Mansfield, who's a fictional character, but a conglomeration of several people he knew. Robert Mansfield was a white man in South Africa who resigns his headmaster position at a school in protest of newly created racist school policies as apartheid was being instituted after World War II. After he's lost his job, he's visited by a Mr. Nene, a black activist, who is told, the black activist tells Mansfield that his decision is going to cost him dearly and wound him deeply. Mr. Nene explains to him, "Mr. Mansfield, people do not like what you're doing, but I'm thinking of joining with you in the battle." Mansfield replies, "Aren't you worried about the wounds, Mr. Nene?" "I don't worry about the wounds. When I go up there, which is my intention, the big judge, the big shoftim," Mr. Nene knows Hebrew, "will say to me, 'Where are your wounds?' And if I say, 'I haven't any,' he will say, 'Was there nothing you felt passionate enough about to fight for?' I could not face that question." I would be afraid of that question too. Was there nothing worth getting wounded for? Where are your wounds? Perhaps church could be about the place, not being the big judge, the big shoftim, asking where are your wounds, but the place where people ask each other, "Hey friend, where are your wounds? Where do you hurt? How can we share in the healing? How can we do this together?" The great Catholic spiritual writer Henry Nouwen wrote a book called The Wounded Healer. That's what we are all called to be. Not folks who have it all together and are fixing other people, but the fellow wounded, healing one another. Remember, that's how they recognize the risen Jesus, by his wounds. That's how they finally knew him, was seeing the marks of the cross that he bore. And I think we are known by our wounds as well. The way we've been wounded, the ways we've been wounded, affects how we connect with the world and connect with each other. It's how we interpret the world and interpret each other. It's only when we have a place, an upper room, where we can meet the risen Jesus in our mutual woundedness, can healing happen. Can Jesus say, "Peace to you, wholeness to you, completeness to you"? I shared this a few years ago, but Barbara Brown Taylor, one of my favorite theologians and preachers, wrote, "Jesus heals us by binding our wounds to his." A poet friend of Barb and mine wrote a prayer to Jesus saying, "You give me this grace that faith is not certainty, but is rather turning toward you. You teach me to hear you in the silence within, to see you where I do see you, to feel your wounds in the wounds of the world. So I reach out my hand, I reach out my hand, I reach out my hand." I chose this painting by Jan Richardson up on the wall for this sermon, and I don't know if it's clear enough on here, but my interpretation of this painting, anyway, is that we enter into life. We enter into reality. We enter into healing. We enter into ourselves by going through Jesus' wounds. We enter into ourselves. We enter into wholeness through Jesus' wounds. That's what Thomas was looking for. He didn't want a creed. He wanted an experience. He didn't want a show. He wanted a relationship. He didn't want a theological or political stance. He wanted a flesh-to-flesh connection. And Jesus offered it to him, an opening, a doorway through the wounds in his hands and feet and side. Spiritual writer after spiritual writer after spiritual writer has said, the surest way of entering the wounds of Christ, where we find wholeness, is by entering the wounds of the world. The surest way of entering the wounds of Christ is by entering the wounds of the world. And that's the other thing church needs to be about. It's welcoming each other in our woundedness, and it's being sent out into the woundedness of the world. Every spiritual writer has said, are you feeling devoid? Are you feeling empty? Are you feeling empty of joy, devoid of meaning, without gratitude? Then get out of the upper room, get into the world with Thomas, and there touch the wounded of the world. If you're feeling empty, you need to fill it with those who hurt. And you've shared stories of how you do that. Volunteering at Respite House, getting hospice training, reading to the blind, tutoring a kid in math, being a mom or a dad with no support, teaching a refugee English. Are you feeling like you are locked in an airless room? Then volunteer at the women's prison. Do you feel like you're stuck under the ice? And spend a night at COTS. Help out the food shelf. Join us at Essex Eats Out or Church Has Left the Building. But touch the wounded. Bind your wounds to theirs, and in so doing, bind your wounds to Christ's wounds, and there find healing, and there find yourself. The gospel is an invitation to come close. Close enough to see the wounds and feel his risen presence and breathe deep of the Spirit that gives life. And then our flesh too can embody God's love. Amen.